You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 7th, 2007. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. And joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Evan Bernstein.
Guten Abend, mein Freunds.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Perry DeAngelis.
Hey, freezing with this global cooling going on.
It's very, very cold in the Northeast here.
Cold outside.
We had an Indian summer. We went straight into an Arctic freeze. It's incredible.
That's for sure.
A few items in the news. One follow-up item. We had talked before about Coke and Nestle coming out with their new Enviga, which is the green tea-flavored diet soda that they say has quote-unquote negative calories. And we basically said that this is pretty much bunk. Well, now the nonprofit Center for Science in the Public Interest has filed a lawsuit against Coca-Cola and Nestle for making fraudulent claims in marketing and labeling for Enviga, basically saying the same thing that we did, that their claims are unfounded and are not proven with evidence.
That's a legit organization?
Yeah, it's a public interest organization. And
did they honestly think, though, that it was going to, just everyone was going to accept it as that without being contested in any way?
You mean Coke?
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, basically, from what I've read, it's heavy on caffeine, and the caffeine increases your metabolism a little bit, right?
People have been drinking their carbonated battery acid for years. Why would they think they'd question this?
Because of the deceptive nature of it, apparently.
No, I think the public will buy it, you know, largely because they buy most things like this fairly uncritically. And anytime someone tells them they could lose weight without exercise or dieting, people are spending lots of money on that. But, you know, the company here is making some specific claims, which is contradicted by evidence. For example, you know, they do claim that it will help weight loss. In fact, in Enviga.
But they don't use that term.
They did do some studies but their studies did not last more than 3 days. There was a European study which found that the ingredients did not help people lose weight after 1 month of study. So the longer-term studies are all negative. The bottom line is that, you know, we do have a Federal Trade Commission, and the FTC has a lot more leeway in going after companies like this than, say, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. They can actually fine companies for making claims that are misleading, and they can force them to change the wording of their advertisements. So something concrete can come out of this.
But like I said before, though, it just seems obvious to me, a company with the money backing it like Coca-Cola, they have companies that do market research. They have you know, a lot of energy put into finding out like what's legal and what's not legal. They have all of these things in place, and yet this kind of slipped through. Like they actually thought there wasn't going to be a response.
I got some dirt on CSPI. There's a lot of organizations that do not agree with their tactics. For example, Bob Barr, former U.S. congressman, says that CSPI does not conduct research but carries out smear campaigns against scientists who publish research which contradicts their ideas.
But that's the whole point. There's always going to be another organization out there fighting what the other group said. Always. I mean, either the stuff has negative calories or it doesn't, for instance.
Yeah, but negative calories don't exist. There's no such thing as negative calories.
Takes more calories to consume the item than the item gives you.
I think what they're claiming is that the caffeine curbs your appetite, which it does.
Yeah, there's another ingredient as well, EGCG, which I think the combination of the two.
Right.
That's
basically
the key. It's the combination.
It encourages your body to burn calories. You know, they word it in such a way as to try to get around the FDA regulations.
That's what they claim.
But again, you know, you guys are mixing, you know, the whole notion of successful marketing versus what the regulations are. You know, the Federal Trade Commission does regulate the accuracy and honesty of commercial claims. So, and most countries probably have something similar. The FDA is sort of a before market, mainly their regulations before market. In other words, they can keep things from getting to the market until they pass some kind of evidence, you know, threshold for safety and effectiveness. But things like supplements are outside now the realm of the FDA. The FDA cannot do any kind of pre-marketing regulation of them. So the only in this country, in the United States, the only line of defense is the Federal Trade Commission, and they've actually been cracking down on weight loss and dieting claims in the marketplace. But Jay, you make it sound like it would be rare or unlikely for a company to make claims that are misleading or that would be that would violate the FTC rules, and they do it all the time. In fact, the FTC is overwhelmed with companies that are making false claims. There's more.
I didn't imply that at all. What I was saying was, you would figure that a company like Coke, like or on that level,
because
that
they're high profile,
puts out hundreds and hundreds of products, right?
They have so many. They figure it into their budget, Jay. They figure the lawsuits in, they figure it the negative publicity in, and they figure it into the budget.
Who knows? This publicity might actually help the product.
That's right. I think it smacks of them entering this arena. They want to sell a product that's got the borderline. Does it do it? Is it going to help me? You know, it's like might as well be a bogus supplement.
Right. Well, I think what this shows, I mean, it'll be very interesting to follow this and see how it plays out, but I think it does show that you really do need some kind of before marketing regulation, and that once the cat's out of the bag, as it were, getting a slap on the wrist from the FTC afterwards, you know, may not have that big of an effect. I mean, I do think a lot of companies just take it as the cost of doing business, and they just sort of change their packaging, change their wording of their claims, and just go about business as usual. So it really hasn't been that effective in the marketplace. It's better than
especially
nothing.
A monster company like Coke.
Do you guys feel that this is kind of shifty what they're doing?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Of course.
Well, I do, because I tell you, there is an increasing epidemic of obesity in this country and in the Western world, not just in the United States, in Western industrialized countries. And a huge contributor to it is the public constantly being bombarded with false claims, with claims of easy ways of losing weight that are not effective. So ineffective diet supplements or diet plans or the latest fad diet book, these are all very counterproductive. I'm not saying they're causing the epidemic, but I think they're contributing to it.
I agree with that. I think that this product in particular, I don't think it's that big of a deal, because I do think that if you can get a large section of the population to trade in their sugary soft drinks for a zero calorie beverage, that's a good thing.
Yes, but I suspect that most people who would do that already are drinking diet or zero calorie colas.
But I think it is a big deal because of the absolute gargantuan size of this company. I mean, this company, Coke, is like McDonald's. You know, it's worldwide. Everybody, you know what I mean? The reach of this company is huge, and it just puts out a really selfish signal to me. Like, yep, we're just going to do this. We know a lot of people are going to find out it's crap, but we'll get through it, and we'll still sell the product, and we'll alter our marketing after the word gets out, and then, you know, we'll make a ton of money, like, you know, just to tap into this other market.
I told you they've been selling carbonated battery acid for years and making billions.
100 years.
We've all seen the tooth dissolving in the Coke.
Oh, that's Perry. That's
it's
a myth.
Garbage.
The tooth dissolving in Coke is a myth.
Yeah, the Mythbusters.
The Mythbusters destroyed that one.
Proved that one.
But it's a great story.
It sticks with you, right, Perry?
I didn't know that.
It's a myth.
Hey,
yeah.
Come on.
Hey guys, but doesn't part of you have, you know, very little sympathy for people that drink Enviga and make it a significant part of their weight loss strategy?
No, I don't blame the victim. I don't blame the victim at all.
I don't know. That's just
sad,
upset
Bob.
To me. It's upset to me that people, I don't know, this seems like they should be a little more sophisticated about dieting with all the, you know, there's lots of bad information out there, but there's also a lot of good information out there. And if you were serious about dieting, you'd think a lot of people, more than do now, would finally realize that, well, yeah, I got to eat less and move more. And that's the bottom line. And why don't people get it?
But Bob, they're being bombarded. They're being bombarded with messages that contradict that.
Yeah. I remember going to McDonald's once, the very few memories left I have of actually walking into a fast food restaurant, and this guy ordered like 4 hamburgers in front of me and a Diet Coke. Like, hello, what are you doing with the Diet Coke? like you just ordered four hamburgers from a fast food restaurant. It's the same. It's the same thing, Bob. It's they fool themselves. They lie to themselves. Like people that have an eating problem or you know trying to lose weight, they want to, but they really don't know how to or aren't trying to. They don't really have the knowledge, or if they do, they don't have the willpower to apply it. It doesn't matter, Bob. What it boils down to is this company's taking advantage. They're taking advantage of people that have willpower problems, or, you know, all the different kinds of reasons why people are overweight. Coke made a decision to take advantage of them and take their money. And I think it's bad.
It's a really tooth won't bad. Dissolve in Coke, huh?
Nope.
That's awesome. I wonder who started that rumor. Pepsi? Yeah.
Gatorade.
Mountain Dew.
What? Yeah, Mountain Dew.
I'll take a crab juice.
So the Iranian Minister of Health has announced that Iranian scientists have cured AIDS. It's cured.
It's all fixed.
Just like done. That. And how did they cure it, doctor?
They did it with Diet Coke.
They cured it with a concoction of herbs. Plants that are all native to Iran, oh my no God. Less.
Persian herbs.
It's a dessert topping. It's a floor cleaner.
Of course, this claim comes out of nowhere. There's nothing published in the scientific literature. There's no basic science establishing how this could possibly work. They just announced, by the way, we've cured AIDS. Now, this was announced as part of a series of announcements on technological and scientific and medical breakthroughs by Iranian scientists, and also part of their appeal to establish that they have nuclear rights. So it's just part of their propaganda.
The Holocaust never happened.
It was in a footnote on their Jews or Monkeys page, you know. P.S. We cured AIDS with herbs.
It's just another example of a totalitarian, oppressive regime using science for propaganda.
With no side effects. With no side effects.
That's right. They claim that the herbal treatment has absolutely no side effects.
Must be homeopathic.
Now, I look back to see if there was anything to indicate that they've been doing this research for the last 7 years, as they claim, and there's really nothing. There's no indication that they've been doing this research. In fact, I saw an interview with the head of the Iranian Center for AIDS Research 1 year ago, and there was no mention of this, no mention that they were engaged in any kind of research program. Interestingly, the Gambian president also has an herbal AIDS cure. He apparently has a history of making kooky claims, and now he's saying that he has been told by whatever powers that be that he can cure AIDS on Thursdays.
Because there's an R in Thursday, you see.
Who is he? I am Thursday, man.
And then and he can cure asthma on Saturdays.
Is Tehran being flooded with HIV patients?
Interestingly, they are having an uptick in their HIV cases due to a sharp rise in heroin and drug abuse, IV drug abuse.
Excellent.
So they've been actually in denial. This is the other thing. They've been really in denial that there even is an AIDS problem in Iran. So it's even more implausible that they've been doing, diligent research for the last 7 years for a problem they have been denying really exists.
It doesn't. Steve, I could see the reasons why they would do this, to bolster their prestige worldwide. But it seems very short-sighted. I mean, granted, they have control over the situation over there, but God, I mean, won't they eventually have to show some people that were cured by their wonder drug?
Bob, they could show 100 people. This guy was cured, he was cured, he was cured.
Yeah, but it just, I mean,
it is all kind of naive, though. It's kind of the naivete of a totalitarian regime that thinks that they can say anything they want and people will believe it, or at least will pretend that they believe it. But I don't think they're really fooling anybody on the world stage.
Right, that's what I'm getting at.
Why would they pick AIDS, though? Why wouldn't they pick cancer or something?
AIDS is sexier.
Well, there could be other motivations. I mean, now they don't have to pay, Western pharmaceutical companies for AIDS drugs. They can just, give Iranian patients with AIDS homegrown herbs. I'm sure it's much cheaper for them. And the sad thing is that the people who are going to ultimately pay the price for this particular piece of propaganda are Iranians with AIDS. I mean, they're not going to get – it's possible that they won't get real effective treatments because their country wants to convince the world for some reason that they have this fake treatment for AIDS. The next news item involves creationists creating nonsense in Kenya. Kenya is a country in Africa where many early human fossils have been found. That is where the famous Leakeys, initially Mary and Louis Leakey, and then their son Richard Leakey, have had their base of operations for all of their fossil hunting over the years. Well, now the National Museum of Kenya wants to put the fossils known as the Turkana boy, which is an early human ancestor.
Probably Homo erectus or Homo ergaster.
That's right, and they want to put them on display. Now, normally fossils like that are kept in humidity-controlled, temperature-controlled drawers in the back of museums somewhere, which is true of most fossils. In fact, when you go to the museum and see, you know, fossils on display that you can touch, they're not real. You know, museums don't like to talk about it too much because they want to give the impression that you're actually feeling real fossils, but the real stuff's always kept locked away somewhere. But they want to put the fossils on display so that people can come and see them, which, you know, occasionally that is done. But a bishop, Bishop Boniface Adoyo, said, "I did not evolve from Turkana boy or anything like it. These sorts of silly views are killing our faith." And he is...
That was an interesting comment, I thought. These sorts of... They're killing their faith. Really? 10 million followers? Yeah, religions... I mean, evolution's really making it inroads. I mean, it's ridiculous that they're killing his faith.
Yeah, the bishop is a leader of 37 evangelical denominations in Kenya and claim over 10 million members. But moreover, he's trying to hide evidence. He's saying that this physical evidence is inconvenient for my beliefs, for my faith. So let's hide it away somewhere and let's not
show
it to the public.
Stop that pesky science, you know.
Richard Leakey made a comment that kind of rubbed me the wrong way. He said that the bishop is descended from the apes, and these fossils tell how he evolved. Now, of course, you know, you really shouldn't say descended from apes, because then that just sets off all these wrong things in people's minds. Really, you know, apes and humans share a common ancestor. I know it's probably a picky little thing, but I'm just surprised he said descended from apes.
We did not evolve from modern apes. Modern apes and humans evolved from a common ancestor that probably is reasonably, you know, characterized as an ape too, but that's okay.
Right.
You're right. But that does cause confusion. You're right. That can cause confusion. But his point was, evolution is a fact. Deal with it. It's silly. It's just silly.
Yeah, that's the important thing to take from this, is that Richard Leakey is out there kicking ass. Over this whole thing, the museum itself, the official statement is that the situation is delicate and we need to express a diversity of visitors' opinions. And Richard Leakey is standing up and saying, screw you guys.
Well, the one fortunate thing is that the nation of Kenya has historically taken pride in the fact that they are the home for a great many important fossil finds, human ancestor fossil finds. So I think in the end that will win the day, and that their national pride will win out over political correctness.
It's too bad the security they have to have for a fossil. Have guards on the doors.
Be great if we could get Richard Leakey for an interview. That would be great.
Incidentally, in 5 days from when we're recording, so on February 12th, is the anniversary of the birthday of Charles Darwin. And this is celebrated by many people as Darwin Day. There's actually a website dedicated to this called darwinday.org, so check it out. And in 2 years, so in 2009, it will be Darwin's 200th birthday.
Steve, you actually read The Origin of the Species, didn't you? Or did? And you said that that's some dry writing.
It is very, I mean, by modern standards, it is incredibly dry. But the thing that's amazing to me still is how much Darwin got right. I mean, he really did put 30 years of research into that one book, you know? He anticipated so many of the objections and questions about evolution and had very cogent ends that was then later confirmed by the discovery of genetics, a genetic inheritance that actually does not get diluted. Well, let's move on to your email.
Hi, I'm John Rennie, the editor-in-chief of Scientific American. And if you're a Scientific American, then you have got to be listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Yeah, we get a lot of emails lately, and I just want to say before we start, man, we are getting, in my opinion, crushed with emails and forum things on this agnosticism versus atheism debate. I'm sure you'd all concur with me.
It's been one of the more lively discussions.
Oh, my God. Over and over and over. And the same thing. And, you know, I just want to say, you know, enough. It's enough. We get it. All right. Yes. You know, I understand.
It's an interesting discussion. I don't want to spend more time talking about it on this episode because we talked about it a lot last week. But I will say, if you are interested in getting in really deep into the nitty-gritty of this discussion, go on our forum. The thread for last week's episode, plus there's a thread just dedicated to this topic under the podcast forum. So we'll, if you want to get into it deeper, I suggest you read and partake in those.
That's threads. Why Steve is a president, because he can answer the same question 52 times. It's true. That's why he's the president.
Actually, what we need, and I think I've mentioned this to you, Jay, but I know we have a lot of things on our plates. We need a fact. You know, and definitely one of my first facts is going to be, what's your stance on religion? And then we could write it once, and I can just refer people to that. All right, the first email comes from Patrick Van Wee in Fountain, Colorado, and he writes, "Hello all, I consider myself an amateur skeptic and really enjoy your podcast. I've been listening for a couple of months now and haven't really disagreed with you so far until now. And it's so bad that I must give you my 2 cents. I'm not sure what your intentions were in having Spencer Weert discuss the critical nature of global warming, but being the skeptics you are, I'm very surprised nobody questioned his statements. After listening to him speak, it's no wonder there are many denialists out there. As is the case with the usual rantings on global warming, Mr. Weert did not provide one shred of scientific evidence to demonstrate the catastrophic human effect on global warming. At the beginning of his diatribe, he inferred that the Earth is obviously warming up because he was just up in New York and cherry trees were blossoming. Do you really consider this evidence? I grew up in upstate New York where the ground was normally covered in snow from November till April, yet even back in the 70s and 80s, we'd have an off year with warmer temperatures and very little snow. Mr. Weird also referred to a study that someone did 20 or 30 years ago. What? If he is a scientist and has solid evidence, why can't he be more specific about the study or at least narrow down the year? Mr. Wirt reflects the typical arguments of the catastrophic global warming movement, and surprisingly, you guys didn't question him on it. I understand the Earth has been warming since the last ice age 20,000 years ago, but until you hear a scientist like Mr. Wirt give quantifiable evidence, I can't accept that cars and power plants are significantly accelerating the process." So this is just a representative email. We've had, you know, quite a few on this topic. This was, you know, I think, almost as lively as the atheism topic in terms of the number of emails that we've had. And which is not surprising. I expected that this would be that we would get this response because there are a lot of skeptics who have not accepted some of the claims or all the claims of the global warming crowd. I do think a few people reiterated some of these specific claims that were made by Patrick in this email, which I don't think are quite fair. Now, first of all, Mr. Weird is not a climatologist. He's a historian, and he wrote a book basically on the history of global warming, which is why I brought him on the show to discuss that. I do admit that I was hoping to get from him a little bit more of meat and sort of nitty-gritty details to talk about, but he basically just said, listen, it's too much really to go over in detail. It's not fair to say that he did not offer evidence. He actually specifically referred to evidence. He basically said, here's the evidence all laid out online. Here are the references. We gave the links on the notes page for that episode. So it's not fair to say that he did not provide evidence. He also was not saying, and this is not fair either, although a couple of people picked up on this, that we know there's global warming because of the cherry blossoms. And it's actually in D.C., not in New York. I mean, come on. I mean, that's not what he was saying. That was maybe just a little, you know, anecdote for emphasis. The bottom line is there's no question that the planet is warming. If you're waiting to hear a scientist say it, then, you know, about a week ago you heard 2,500 scientists saying it. There was the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was a report that was put together by 2,500 scientists. Relevant scientists in their area, you know, of expertise, and they reviewed all of the data that we have to date, and they said that the planet is definitely in a warming phase. Again, I don't think that there's really anybody, you know, serious who denies that, and they said the probability that human influences are forcing the, at least are partly responsible for this, a process called forcing, is about 90%, which again, I think is a fairly honest way to say it. They're not saying it's absolutely certain or there's no question. They said it's 90%, which, you know, is the kind of statement that you expect responsible scientists to make, to put some kind of, you know, error bars or percentage on their statements. So, you know, they are using language that there is a solid consensus. There really is no really longer any debate about whether or not human influences are partly responsible for global warming. Now, I did note that recently there was an article published by George Will, who is a political writer, but he is a very intellectual, thoughtful person. I often, you know, think that he puts together his thoughts in a very careful way. And he has been one of the people who is certainly a holdout on the global warming issue. One thing in his article that I thought was very helpful, he laid out actually he broke down the claims of global warming into six specific subclaims, which I think is helpful in discussing it. One is global warming is happening. Two is it is our, meaning humanity's, fault. Three, it will continue unless we mend our ways. Four, if it continues, we are in grave danger. Five, we know how to slow or even reverse the warming. And six, the benefits from doing that will far exceed the costs. Now, he says that there's really only a scientific consensus or certainty on number one and not two through six. I disagree with that. I think that certainly number one, I would say...
And two.
Saying that, I would have to add two.
Is he aware of this 2,500 scientist consensus? Because he made no mention of that in the entire article. What does that mean that he didn't even talk about this recent... you know, gargantuan event in global warming news.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that it warranted a mention in that article. And I totally disagree with him. I think saying that we're 90% certain it's playing a role is an accurate statement. Now, of course, you can always quibble about how much of a role is it playing. And I think there the IPCC said it's significant. You know, it's actually – it's. You can't say, oh, yeah, sure, it's there, but it's 1%, therefore we could forget about it. No, it's there and it's significant. Will it continue unless we mend our ways? I think what you could say is that the human forcing of global warming will continue unless we stop, you know, doing what we're doing. That doesn't mean that global warming itself will continue, because if we go into a natural cooling period, that might offset the human warming that we're doing, right?
Right.
So it's still possible that it's also interestingly true that we are also in a period of a natural warming that is being was at least partly caused by solar forcing, by increased solar activity. So, of course, the those who deny the human contribution to global warming point to that. But the fact is both are happening. Although I think we discussed maybe a few months ago on the show that we may be coming to the end of the solar warming period, which is a good thing. So it's actually even possible that the short-term trend may reverse a little bit, but we have to look at the long-term trend in climate. You know, over decades and over centuries, you know, if we're forcing an upward trend, there may be this background of up and down, but the long-term trend is going to be of human forcing will lead upward. So I think I disagree with him on 3-2, but with that further explanation. If it continues, we are in grave danger. Now, here is where we start to get shaky. No one really does know what the consequences of this are going to be.
Al Gore knows.
I think that Weir was very honest in saying that Al Gore, you know, overstates the negative outcomes.
Well, maybe the time. I thought he specifically mentioned the time frame. It's not quite as imminent as Gore may lead you to believe. But in 100 years, even if the progression is slow, you know, given 100 or 200 years, it's not going to be nice.
You're right, Bob. I mean, I think it is misleading to say that it's going to cause this, you know, much rise in the ocean without saying this is over 200 years. And I think that's significant also because we don't know what our technology is going to be like in 50 years, let alone 100 or 200 years. So
don't get me started.
It's you of all people, Bob, don't realize that we may be dealing with completely different technological infrastructure by then. That doesn't mean we don't need to worry about it. It just means it's hard to get too excited about things 200 years down the road. But he also, you know, Will makes the point, and again, I'm using this article just as an example of a very cogent explanation of the sort of anti-global warming position. He said that we don't really, you know, that there have been periods in in history, in geological history, certainly, where the Earth has been cooler and other times when the Earth has been warmer. And who's to say that the temperature as it is right now is the way it's quote-unquote supposed to be or is perfect and that we should do everything we can to keep it exactly as it is now? And that is true as far as it goes, but I think it's also misleading because of this. We do have a vested interest in keeping the climate, you know, from changing too much, especially if it's, you know, if it's a natural trend, that's one thing. But if we're forcing the climate to change is a bad thing because we've built cities on lots of coastlines. It doesn't matter if you don't have cities on coastlines, you know, but if you do, then you don't want to have the oceans rise even by a few feet. Also, we have an infrastructure that's, you know, that is based upon where good farmland is right now. And if that shifts, you know, if, for example, the American Midwest became a desert and the Sahara became good farmland, you know, that may be good, you know, for people living in northern Africa, but that would certainly be very destabilizing to the industrialized world.
And, Steve, you know, I think all of what you just said gives us the right to say, yeah, it's kind of right the way it is now. And we shouldn't be forcing drastic changes because of all that.
Yeah, from a practical point of view, because we've built our civilization around it, and if it changes, it may not be objectively better or worse, but it's worse for us, you know, on the short term of decades and the one or two centuries.
Steve, when did Will write this article?
This is very recent.
February
12th issue, which is the current issue of Newsweek. Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Which is why I'm using it, because it's very, very current. I also came across, through my recent readings on global warming, something called the Petition Project. And this is an article written by a group which is just called the Petition Project. And interestingly, it basically says that the data shows that there is no global warming and that increased CO2 in the atmosphere is a good thing because it will actually encourage plants and animals to grow. That we're basically releasing carbon into the environment that will then get turned into plants and animals. It's very, very dubious, the entire project. Well, first of all, the website is designed to look like a published peer-reviewed article. And that is certainly what I thought when I saw it. You know, as a physician and a scientist, I read published work all the time, including online. And to my eyes, it looked like it was published and peer-reviewed, and it's not. It's really just a mock-up to make it look as if it is.
Yeah, look at that.
So
wow.
It's very deceptive. It's very, very deceptive to do that because it's not a published peer-reviewed article. And the claims, the specific scientific claims that are made within it have been pretty thoroughly refuted, some, you know, in the past. So, again, ignoring past refutations of your arguments is kind of a intellectually dishonest thing to do as well. There really isn't any evidence to suggest that, you know, this simplistic sort of notion that putting more carbon into the atmosphere is just going to get recycled into plants and animals. There's actually what happens to the carbon is far more complex. So,
and insidious.
Yeah, that's right. So I'll have links to both that article and a response to it so you could sort of get both sides in our notes page as well. So, I mean, I think this is a very interesting debate for skeptics. It is certainly one of those science issues that a reasonable, you know, skeptical scientific person could take either position. I do think if you do look at all of the facts and you bow to the scientific consensus, which I think is reasonable, then, you know, the more reasonable position is that, yes, there is global warming, yes, there is a human component to it, and we have at least reasons to suspect that there may be untoward outcomes from it.
Also, it's kind of interesting to see the transformation from global warming skeptics to global warming deniers.
Yeah, I mean that term. I admit I was a little uncomfortable with that term because it is so inflammatory. It's so inflammatory, and of course, people who think they're skeptics don't like to be about anything. Don't like to be labeled as deniers.
Right.
Just like, you know, deniers are going to label scientists true believers. You know, and true believers will think skeptics are deniers. So sometimes those terms are thrown around as kind of an ad hominem attack. So I don't know, you know, if we're quite at the point where you would say, you could say that anybody who has any sort of misgivings about the whole notion of global warming is a quote-unquote denialist or a denier. I think it maybe is unnecessary and inflammatory. It's not at the same – I mean, I think that creationists are evolution deniers, and that's unequivocal. And they're so far into that end of the spectrum that I feel
right.
no inhibition about using
and
that term.
Holocaust deniers.
Yeah, and Holocaust deniers too. I think, yeah, global warming, yeah.
I certainly am closer to the George Will school of thought on this issue. And I don't want to be called a denier. I think that the planet's warming, and I think that humans contribute. It's just a matter of degree.
But then from a practical point of view, and this is where Will makes some good points, where his good points are, you know, we can't take the sort of hysterical position that we have to do these really radical, ridiculous things in order to prevent, you know, any global warming, because we know that all these horrible things are going to be happening. We do want to keep our heads about us and think about the steps that we make. Are they rational? Are they going to have a good return on investment, if you will? Are they going to have an effect that's worth the price that we're going to pay for them? And go through this process in a rational way. And, of course, I think there are sort of environmentalists at the other end of the spectrum who are basically making propositions that are unreasonable. There's also always there is a segment that is basically anti-corporate, anti-industrialization, that are using this to promote that agenda. But so that's part of the political spectrum. We certainly have the corporate shills on one end of the spectrum politically, and then the environmentalists on the sort of anti-corporate, anti-industrialist on the other end of the spectrum. So there is this political dimension to this scientific issue, which is why it's so heated, no pun intended. and why I think that, so normally if you got 2,500 scientists together that systematically review all the data and say, yeah, this is a fact, usually that's good enough. You know, that's an issue does not remain controversial unless there is such a deep, political dimension to it, which is what I think why this is such an interesting
Steve
topic.
Why do you think there's such a polarization, though? Why are people so hardcore believing it and so hardcore not believing it? Why
again, like anything, it comes down to ideology, because people's ideologies trump the science.
The reason why I ask is because we've even had the differences in our amongst ourselves about this topic. And people can tend to get emotional about it. And I, for some reason, from the very beginning with global warming, it was a very simple topic to me. I just said, well, if it's happening and humans are causing it, then we should do things to prevent it. I don't have any ideology attached to it whatsoever. And that's why I can't relate to people getting just so fired up and angry about.
The other thing, Jay, is that there are very practical decisions at stake here. It's not just whether or not scientifically you think there's man-made global warming or not, it's what should we do about it? And we have to act in the absence of certitude. And some of those actions may be, economically very difficult to do. I mean, should we shift to nuclear power plants? Should we, how much effort do we need to put in conservation?
Depending on who you listen to, some of the things they're asking for, frankly, are insane. Yeah, that's my opinion. If you're an alarmist,
but I think that the at the other side, they try to say that there's this conspiracy to rob America of its industrial advantage by deindustrializing, the West and America specifically. That's just as hysterical as the environmental wackos, in my opinion.
I agree.
But those are the ideologies that we're confronting. So, in any case, we got to make tough decisions with imperfect data. Ideologies come to the fore, and it's going to stay that way, I think, for a while, despite this growing scientific certitude and consensus.
Well, I guess we have to keep our fingers crossed and hope technology ultimately saves the day here.
I hope that's the case. I think that, I think it will. It's just a matter of when and how much damage will be done in the meantime. The other angle to this that Will brings out is that what we do – the other point he makes is that what the United States does at this point is almost irrelevant because China is building all these coal-fired plants, and even just what they do is so overwhelming that it's really not within our power to affect right now.
There's something to that. I mean, China's emissions are growing at 3.6% per year. India's at 4.5%, and we're growing at 0.9% a year. So I think before we make any sweeping changes that apply to us, it would make sense to make sure other countries are doing the same thing, because then we will be hurting ourselves and we wouldn't be really addressing the issue.
The next one comes from Daniel Cohen in right here in Connecticut. And he writes, "Hi, guys. I was listening to your show, podcast number 77, and you asked if there were any 10-year-old skeptics. I am 11 years old. It'll be 12 in May, and I wanted to let you guys know that there was a 10-year-old skeptic out there." Well, we did get a lot of emails in response to our question. We appreciate it. Thanks for sending them all in. But this one wins the prize. I didn't count people who were like in their 40s and 50s and said that they were a skeptic when they were a little kid. I wanted somebody who actually was a kid right now and out there. So Daniel Cohen gets our award for the youngest skeptic listening to our show.
Way to go, Daniel.
Daniel. Good work, tell your friends. I'm curious, though. How did you find us? I mean, how did you stumble across our podcast? Curious.
Yes. Yeah, let us know. He's right here in Connecticut, so the next time we have a local meeting, we'll have to make sure to let you know so you can come.
Absolutely.
I have always said that Daniel Cohen is a fine young man. I've always said that.
And then one final email. This one is actually just a quick correction of sorts. "Greetings, Steve and gang. Thanks for the useful and entertaining podcast. Steve's comment that Martin Gardner was a deist may come as a surprise to Martin Gardner if you ask him. Mr. Gardner certainly still is, because he is. So referring to Martin in the past tense is rather premature. Randy recently gave readers of Swift the opportunity to send Martin cards on his birthday. By the way, Martin's book, The Whys of the Philosophical Scrivener, has a chapter, Why I Am Not an Atheist. Of course, it isn't news to any of you that Martin is as important to the skeptical movement and skeptical literature than anyone else has ever been. And it's gratifying that others like Michael Shermer, Randy, etc. have come along. For a long time, the movement was Martin's, and we are a better world for his prolific pen."
Oh, yeah.
He goes on to say some other things, but basically he says, "Long live Martin Gardner and his legacy, including The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe."
Here, here.
Jay DeLong, Olympia, Washington. Well, Jay, thanks for that. Actually, I did talk about Martin Gardner in the past tense. It was inadvertent. I know that Martin is alive.
Jeez.
Did not mean to imply that he had passed away. So reports of his death were highly exaggerated.
That is pathetic, Steve. I am shocked at you. Next thing you're going to be going around saying teeth dissolving coke.
Only a loser would think that.
I'm outraged.
Got to keep you guys on your toes. But I guess, as I think, I might think of Martin in the past tense because he's had kind of a low profile recently. I think he's still writing and stuff, but he doesn't come to meetings and, you know, and to skeptical events, and he hasn't had his column in the Skeptical Inquirer recently. So, but he has not thankfully passed on. So thanks for the correction. Well, this week we have part three of our TAM 5 interviews, and we will include portions of our interviews with Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, and also with Adam Savage and Tori Belleci from the Mythbusters. Sitting with us now is Phil Plait, the bad astronomer. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure.
So how are you enjoying the conference so far?
I haven't really been experiencing it that much. Been running around too much.
Yeah, everyone's
seems
quite
to
busy.
Happen a lot.
That's pretty much the way to experience it these days.
Well, you have to be pretty flexible with skeptics. You know, there's a lot of scheduling delays and all sorts of basically barely manageable chaos at these meetings.
So, Phil, what are you going to be talking about later on?
I'll be doing the moon hoax talk, which is debunking the Fox TV show that said that the moon landings are fake. It's a good lesson in critical thinking.
Yeah.
A lot of the basics are there about evidence that's used and misused, and how people can phrase things to make things sound logical when in fact they're nonsense, and how you can change topics rapidly. Don't give people time to think about things. How you can give them most of the information they need to make a decision, but not that key piece of information which shows that everything this guy is saying is just crap.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right.
We were actually just talking about this with Richard Wiseman, about how you can really connect with people when you hit something that's immediately relevant to them.
Sure.
And what's more relevant than the movies that they're watching?
And even TV shows don't have that sort of universality. Like, I don't watch 24, or I guess that's a Fox show.
You should, though. It's a great show.
Never been a big Kiefer Sutherland fan ever since, I guess, Lost Boys. But But with something about the movies, I mean, I could talk about Battlestar Galactica, I could talk about Lost or any of these big popular shows, and I'll still leave a lot of people behind. But if you mention a movie like Armageddon or Deep Impact, well, if you, you know, these were 7-8 years ago now, it's been too long. But you mention movies like that, Superman Returns. Mm-hmm. And you say, how does Superman stop a plummeting airplane by putting his hand on the nose of the plane? Shouldn't the plane just be crushed? He should put his hand right through it. You know, it doesn't make sense. And everybody's like, oh, yeah. You know, they saw that scene. They remember it.
My classic version of that is when somebody's jumping off of a building. Superman swoops down and grabs them, and there's no deceleration. It's an instant stop, and he would, like, have a sack of skin in his hand.
He immediately negates their entire, you know, velocity towards the ground. It's like that.
Actually, there was a Spider-Man comic about that.
I was about to mention this, where the woman falls off the bridge. And this is in the physics of superheroes, I think. Yeah. And this girl falls off a bridge, right? And he uses his web to catch her.
And she snaps her neck or
something. Yeah, he kills her. Winds up killing her.
Yeah.
She would have died anyway.
Yeah, she was done for.
But, I mean, it's like, how totally cool is that?
But, yeah, so Spider-Man beats Superman on the proper physics.
Of course, he was bitten by a radioactive spider, so.
That's true. Yeah. That can happen.
We'll watch TV shows sometimes, and somebody's a superhero's flying around, and they'll do something stupid, and then my wife will say, now how am I supposed to believe that? And it's like, hun, it's a guy flying. You know, you're sort of missing the forest with the trees.
He puts on his glasses and nobody knows who he is.
Disbelief.
So I think there's a psychological statement to be made there. There are ridiculous scientific fallacies that we see every day on TV shows, and yet when something happens that's really trivial, you know, we'll focus on that. It's like, but Superman's flying. Come on, you know, don't worry about, you know, in the last episode, red kryptonite made him crippled, you know. It's like, that's not the point, you know. Yeah.
You're allowed one thing about your world that you don't have to explain. You just take it for granted.
Yeah.
It's what makes it a fantasy
world.
There
are vampires
here. But you don't get two or three guineas. You can't go beyond that.
In the science fiction world, it's called a MacGuffin. Mm-hmm. There's a device that's a magical device.
Right.
That
Actually, that's a mystery novel term.
Oh, is it?
It's
a mystery.
Originally
okay, that's right. You're right. Yeah. In astronomy, we call it a tooth fairy. Mm-hmm. If you have an idea about some phenomenon, and you say, well, let's just assume this is happening. Mm-hmm. And that's one tooth fairy. You're not allowed a second tooth fairy.
Yeah, and from there you have to extrapolate. Well, if that's happening, then this.
You can't
it's
say
kind
if
of an
this,
Occam's razor.
Yeah.
But at some point,
minimize your assumptions.
But at some point, you have to address the tooth fairy, I would assume.
Yeah, but if you can build a consistent picture by making some leap of logic that is self-consistent and actually is predictive, it'll say, you know, we know the Big Bang is true. But we're having these problems with some of the observations. Well, let's assume that there was a short period of time shortly after the universe was formed where it expanded super quickly.
Let's try to support that contention.
Okay, and then, well, this explains a lot of disparate phenomena. It predicts this. And, oh, look, the predictions are right. That's what happened with inflation theory, which is this idea that for a brief fraction of a second, I mean like 10 to the minus 35 seconds, something crazy like that,
The
universal expansion just accelerated hugely and then slowed back down. And it was totally made up.
Yeah. But it turned out, explanatory.
But it explained so many things, and people started realizing that it may actually be correct, and they were able to figure out what might cause it.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's totally accepted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's separate from the Big Bang because it happened after long enough after that it's sort of a separate model. But it is part of the standard.
Long enough after, like
10 to the minus 42 seconds, or whatever. Yeah,
everything's relative.
But it keeps, you know, these are separate models, but they're now a part of the standard cosmology. You have the Big Bang, inflation, dark matter, dark energy. And I still get people emailing me saying, oh, this dark energy, this dark matter, it's ridiculous. And it's like, well, they just had a press release where they've just mapped out dark matter from here out to 6 billion light years.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Very impressive. And it's like, in your face. You know?
But that's you focused in on the point, though, is it makes predictions.
Yes.
And that's the cornerstone of science.
This dark matter release that was out in January where they were able to map out this stuff using, it's a lot of different complicated physics. But the beauty of it is that they were able to take their data and say, here's where the normal matter is, here's where the dark matter is, and you look at the two pictures, and they looked really similar.
They overlap a lot.
And you say, this is exactly according to theory, that the dark matter formed giant structures first, these huge structures, billions, hundreds of millions of light years across, and then the normal matter fell into that.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd expect that the two of them side by side would look alike.
Like the dark
and
matter,
they do.
And the dark matter just, skeleton. It was like the dark matter skeleton and regular matter is kind of around
a
that.
Framework, a skeleton. Right. These are great words. Mm-hmm. And I was at the press conference where they announced this. And I mean, you could just hear everybody go, oh. All the science, the journalists who were scientists, and the scientists in the audience were all like, oh, that totally rocks. It was very cool.
It's funny. Evan sent us an email with that, and for some bizarre reason, just by glancing at the title, I got the impression that they knew what dark matter was. So as I'm reading it, I'm like, okay, where is it? Where? And I got to the end, I'm like,
we don't know what the hell this stuff is, but we've got a map of it.
Well, we know it's going to be there. Yeah. We know what it does. We just know what it is.
Well, this is another thing about science that I just love. Here's an observation of this guy named Fritz Zwicky. He's an astronomer in the 1930s. He's looking at clusters of galaxies, and these are collections of hundreds of galaxies like the Milky Way, and they're all orbiting each other like a beehive. Well, you can measure the velocities of the galaxies in there by using the Doppler shift. It's a trivial thing to do. You can do it very easily. The thing is, when he looked at all the light coming from these galaxies, and he said, well, let's assume they're filled with stars like the Sun. So for every amount of light that the galaxy's emitting, like the Sun, I'm assuming there's one solar mass of material emitting it. So if I see a billion times the Sun's light coming from this galaxy, I'm assuming it has a billion times the Sun's mass. Mm. And when you do that, and you measure the velocities of the galaxies, you realize the gravity of the cluster is not nearly enough to hold the cluster together. These guys are moving too quickly. This thing will evaporate like bullets shooting out of a gun. And so why is this thing still being held together after billions of years? Well, the creationists would have an answer for that. It would be the wrong answer, that the universe is young. Exactly. We know that these galaxies were billions of years old, and there's no way these clusters could have been lasting that long. So he said, well, it sounds to me like there's 90% of the matter in this cluster is dark. And everybody went, that's insane. Well, years later, they found another, I won't go into too much detail, but they found more and more evidence that a lot of matter in the universe is dark. And people started to really believe it, and they said, well, let's start thinking about what it could be. It could be dead stars, planets, whatever. But all of these things would have some sort of tell. They would emit light or do something that you could see them. Nothing. Now, but what the thing is, we know it's there, so it became clear that this stuff is made of some weird matter that's not like normal matter. And then last year, they came out with a discovery that, in fact, they could show that the dark matter does not interact with normal matter except through gravity. It's a big, complicated thing. If you go on my blog and look up bullet cluster, you'll find it, because there's this cluster called the bullet cluster. But again, you know, this is a scientific theory that was crazy at first, but inevitable. We had this big problem, and there had to be some solution to it. And people want to deny it. You know, of course, they try to attack it, and that's what happened. And it survived. Now, there are people who are still trying to attack it because they don't want the universe to be old. They don't want there to be a big bang, whatever. And they say dark matter is baloney. And I got to tell you, you know, it has really withstood a lot of trials by fire.
And let them try to attack it. That's
and this last one is like, if you can explain, you know, why we see all of this gravitational distortion of galaxies from a long way off without invoking dark matter, I want to hear it.
Well, Phil, thanks for sitting with us. Yeah. Looking forward to your talk.
Superman's cool.
Yeah. I can't wait to see the moon hoax.
This will be fun.
It'll be awesome.
Totally.
No, thanks.
Thank you.
Right. Always a pleasure. Thanks, Phil.
Take it easy.
Bye.
So sitting with us now is Adam Savage of the MythBusters. Adam, thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know you guys run ragged when you come up to these TAM meetings. And sitting to your left is Tori. Thanks, both of you, for joining us. You're going to be talking later on today.
Yes.
Just give us a little preview. What are you guys going to be talking about?
Well, last year Jamie and I came, and we did kind of our standard spiel that we do at colleges and corporate events around the country, where we do a little bit of talking with a moderator on stage. We were lucky enough to have Penn Jillette interview us on stage last year, and he was really generous and amazing. Then we showed some clips from the show, and then we took questions from the audience. This year, since I figure there's a lot of repeat visitors,
we're just going to wrestle. It's going to be on all-out fight.
Exactly. We need some jello.
We're going to be beating each other up.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about how the show got started, how we both came to be on the show, because Tori got to be on the show after it started, so he had a perception of both a before and an after, and that changed. I've also brought a slightly pared-down version of the original demo reel that got Jamie and I the job, which is kind of a treat to see. There's a lot that's interesting about it.
Did you guys know what you were getting into when it first started? Like, how did they contact you, and then what went on from there?
We had no idea what we were getting into when it started. It was shocking. You know, I was actually at that point flying back and forth to New York trying to develop a children's television series. And I actually remember having lunch with Tori, because we were both working on The Matrix.
Yeah, he left Matrix for, I don't know, a couple of weeks to go...
About 6 weeks to do the pilots for MythBusters.
So he left, went off to do the pilot, And then he came back, and we were all just kind of waiting around to see if the show was going to get picked up.
But we were having this lunch, and I was like, yeah, you know, this children's television series, this is the one that we got lots of power behind, some guys from NBC. It's going to be really great. This is the one I think is really going to take off. And Tori's like, yeah, but dude, this Mythbuster thing sounds amazing. That's the one you should go for. And I'm like, yeah, that's never going to happen.
So whose idea was that originally?
It was originally Peter Reese. He was a producer for Beyond 2000. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember the magazine-style show for about 10 years.
Love
and he actually interviewed Jamie and peripherally I as part of a segment they did on Robot Wars back in 1994. Jamie had designed, and I did the remote control system for a robot called Blendo that was just absolutely devastating, had become quite famous.
Oh, God, I'm such a geek, I remember that.
I was actually at one of the fights where they disqualified Blendo because it was too dangerous. Mm-hmm. We were sitting behind...
Too dangerous.
We were sitting like two rows back, and a piece of the other robot came flying at the plex, and it cracked it.
Did it?
Oh, I remember. I know exactly where you were sitting.
I was like sitting right in front of the glass where it hit, and they're like, okay, it's too dangerous.
So Peter, as a good producer, never throws away a phone number. And in spring of 2002, he contacted Jamie and said, would you be interested in hosting this show? And Jamie contacted me and said, you know, these guys want to see a demo reel. And I was like, well, I can come in next week and do it. And he said, no, they want to see it like Friday, and they're in Australia, so we need to do it right now.
Yeah.
So I went in with my Sony DV cam, and Jamie's assistant Chris filmed a second camera. We shot 2 hours of footage. I cut it into a 14-minute demo reel, which was just, you'll see it today. Jamie and I talking. There are...
But you had an idea of what you wanted to do, though, at that point.
We didn't know what the structure of the show would be. They told us, we want to see you guys introduce yourselves, talk on camera, and then we want you to discuss a myth. That's it. That's all. That's the full scope of what we got. When you see it, you'll be shocked, because what we did was pretty much the show.
Yeah. So this is discuss a myth, and you said, okay, but we have to add in some violence and danger.
Well,
and we throw a hot babe in there, too, just for good measure.
We blew something up. Yeah. At some point, I said to Jamie, you know, can we blow something? Can we make a big fireball? Jamie goes, yeah. And then there's a shot of us running from the fireball, you know.
Yeah.
Did you have any idea that because of the show, there was any... It was going to have influence on the world of skepticism, and it was going to...
Did you know there was a world of skepticism before the show?
I had some peripheral knowledge that there was a thing called the Skeptical Inquirer and Skeptics magazine.
Did you know James Randi?
Of course I knew James Randi. Yes. I was watching Happy Days in 1972.
That's where I met.
When he was first on.
Yep.
I was watching that Tuesday night with my babysitter. So when James Randi contacted me for TAM 4... and said, we'd love you to be on, you're one of our heroes. And I was like, jeez, James Randi, I'm not your hero, man. That was amazing. I mean, it's the amount of access that I've found, that we've all found from moving around in the world, from doing this show, the people that respond to it, and the kind of peerage you find among scientists and professionals and people with brains that want to actually look at the world is astonishing.
I remember when I was first watching the show, it came on, and of course I'm like, oh yeah, this is right up my alley. I love this kind of stuff. And then, like, three or four episodes into it, it occurred to me, like, it all kind of clicked together. I'm like, holy shit, these guys are really good skeptics. Like, everything that they do, all the logic that they apply, all totally fits right in. And then I was hooked. It really does. The show absolutely has such a strong skeptical spine to it.
Well, I have high hopes for this next couple of seasons in trying out some really radical stuff. I'd like to. You know, we spent 7 months testing. Tori spent 7 months testing whether a Rolling Stone gathers any moss.
Oh, is that an exciting episode?
What? Yeah, I remember that with the wheel.
That thing. Still one of my favorites.
If we can spend 7 months in a myth, I'd like to prove natural selection.
Mm-hmm. Oh man!
Show it actually occur on television.
Wow! And then we might go over the Niagara Falls.
So Tori, how did you ever get yourself? Did you call these guys up after they were famous? Like, dude, I'm coming down on the show.
No, absolutely not. It was funny because he, you know, we had worked for years. Actually, Jamie gave me my first job building models, and they'd left to go do the show, and I was still working at Lucasfilm. I just finished working on Van Helsing, and I remember sitting out on the stage, looking around, going, you know, I'm going to be doing this forever. Like, this isn't going to lead to anything new, but, you know, whatever. And then, like, 3 days later, he called, and he was like, I got an opportunity. It could change your life. And he was like, we need more.
That was a message I left. Tori, call me. Change your life.
So he's like, awesome. he's all, just do a video of you building something or demoing something, whatever, to show to the people at Discovery. So I did it, and
tell them what you did.
Oh, I did the myth do women fart. And so I mean, it was a total spoof.
But we all want to know, right?
What I did. Right? So I went to a taqueria, and I put a microphone underneath a table, and then as girls sat down,
the best part about this video is that
called the guy
he's like, I want to find out if girls fart, so I'm going to go to Taco Bell, and we're going to put a microphone under the seat, and then this music kicks in.
But it was totally set up. Like, I put in fart sound effects, but it was just to show my personality.
It was great. He put in fart sound effects, and then so you hear all these...
Yeah.
And all these random... It's the thing you could do, and you don't have to get anyone to sign a release for, right? Yeah. All these poor random ladies
just sitting there.
Sitting, and you just hear these terrible farts, and you cut the Tory going...
Do you still have that available? Is that on YouTube right now?
It's somewhere. It's definitely somewhere, yeah.
Awesome. Do you guys have any kind of scientific consultants for your show or to help you sort of get the science right about what you do?
It's always been... Of course, I mean, most of the show is finding out after the fact that we really screwed up.
Right.
That we didn't know about some thing that we should have known about. And in our desire to first, you know, accurately research, it's really difficult to find that one person in 100,000 who really knows what you're talking about.
And you just don't have the time. I mean, it's like we don't have the time to do all the research before we do the myth. It's like, go. And as you're going, you're, like, learning new stuff. And it's like, oh, if only we had known this earlier, that would have changed how we, we're going to experiment, try this experiment. And by then, it's too late.
And the researchers do an amazing job. Our research team is a crack team of people who really, I mean, the level of enthusiasm you see us display on camera is actually exemplified in the entire crew, about 20 strong in San Francisco. I mean, everybody is that excited when we get something right, when an experiment goes off well. And even then, when they own these myths and they really research them for weeks or months sometimes, they don't necessarily have the type of perspective on it that we might have and might not know to look down a certain avenue.
I see.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to figure out which one is the fake, and you can play along.
There's global warming.
Are you guys?
Sorry.
Are you guys ready?
Yes.
All right. Let's get to it. Number one.
I just want you guys to know I have to get money? All of these right from now on because money
That's
is
right.
on
They're
the
actually.
Line.
Listeners on the forum actually betting on Jay's performance on science or fiction.
Now, it was Mike.
Mike
on the forum. He basically says he's going to donate. I don't remember.
$25.
Was it $25 per person I beat?
Per person you take over.
Perry,
yeah. In other words, if my average goes up above Perry's, he's going to donate $35. And then if I finally get all the way up to the Bob and Rebecca zone, he's going to give us like $350 or something.
Let's see how you do today. Ready? Number one, Harvard scientists have successfully turned a light beam into matter and then back into light again with the exact same properties and at a different location. Item number two, a study finds that children who sleep more are less likely to be overweight. And item number three, a new study demonstrates that playing video games for 2 or more hours a day worsens visual acuity. Perry, why don't you go first?
So the light beam thing is obviously true. That's the Scotty project.
I've
heard of that. The second one now was what happened?
Children who sleep more are less likely to be overweight.
Children who sleep more. Let's see. So sleeping less is what fat guys do. So does that correlate?
That follows, yes.
Okay, all right. And then the last one is video worsens visual acuity.
Yes.
Well, it's got that hand-eye thing going on. I mean, that's good, right? And get your reflexes up there. So the second one sounds good. So the first one's got to be crap.
So
first one's fake.
The light beam is fiction.
Project.
Okay.
Yeah.
Evan?
Boy, I'm stuck between the sleep relation to weight loss and the visual acuity relationship to video games. I'm really on the fence on these two. One of those two is fiction. Rats. Okay, I got to make a guess, so I'm going to guess that the more kids sleep, the less likely they are to be overweight is fiction.
Okay, Jay?
I distinctly remember reading things about the last two, so but I know the first one is not. I'm going to go with the first one.
With the light beam.
Yeah.
Okay, Rebecca?
Okay, I'm pretty sure that sleeping more is actually better for your health and better for your weight. And the light beam through the matter thing is just insane, but somehow I think that that one's probably true. So I think that it's the video game one. I think that video games actually might help your hand-eye coordination.
Okay, Bob?
The answer is three. Videos improve visual acuity by 20%, by the way.
Okay. So, Jay and Perry, you think that the light beam one is fake. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is the easier.
Silence is gold.
Yeah, all okay. Right. That one is science. That one is science. This is a cool new study.
Yeah, it was interesting.
They basically shot, you know, a laser or a light beam into a cloud of Bose-Einstein condensate. Yeah, right.
What?
It's
what about Heisenberg and, you know, it's uncertainty.
These are an ultra-cold cloud of about 2 million sodium atoms, and I think the thing that makes it a Bose-Einstein condensate is that they're all sort of lined up in the same orientation or something.
No, they behave as one quantum system.
Okay.
So one equation is, I guess you could put it, could describe it.
Okay, so the light, but you said the light beam turns into matter.
That's right. So it enters into it, the light beam ends, it stops, and then it turns into some kind of matter particle, which then travels for a while to another cloud, and then it turns back into the light beam. And because it's basically, it's still entangled, I guess, from a quantum point of view. So when it turns back into a light beam, it has the same exact properties as it did before when it went in. Now, the reason this is potentially interesting, other than just it's another weird quantum effect, is that this could give us the ability to manipulate light beams, which has potential for, say, optical computers or optical information transfer. Light uses a very little energy, travels very fast, obviously, so it's a good sort of medium for switching. But the problem is it's really hard to control. This might be a way of controlling it. You can turn it into a matter particle, which then can be easily manipulated and then back into light again.
So what kind of matter particle? Like, what does a light beam look like when it turns into matter?
It just said messenger atoms.
Are these... is this matter intelligent?
Is it a new life form?
Is it sentient?
So, although I wouldn't expect everyone having personal computers with Bose-Einstein condensates inside them, but
not anytime soon, anyway.
No, not for at least 18 months.
I don't know, Steve. That's pretty shifty what you tried to pull off there. The light doesn't actually turn into matter.
It does, Jay. It does. That part
that's how it was described.
I'm outraged.
Let me ask you a question. What do facts prove anyway, right?
The next one, study finds that children who sleep more are less likely to be overweight. Evan,
yes.
You
well, no, actually,
fake.
I thought either this one or the acuity one, and
right.
I basically
you thought this
flipped
one
a
was
coin.
Fake, and in fact, this one is
my coin came up wrong,
and it is. It does have to do probably just with overall health. This is the study is just a correlation. They really didn't demonstrate why kids that sleep more are less overweight. But kids do need a lot more sleep than you might think. 6 to 10-year-olds probably should be getting like 10 or 11 hours of sleep a night. Preteens, like 8 or 9 hours of sleep a night. And often they don't get enough. And the not getting a full night's sleep did correlate with being overweight. Which means that a new study demonstrates that playing video games for 2 hours or more a day worsens visual acuity is fiction. So Bob and Rebecca both got it correct. And Bob, you obviously read this article because it says the study showed that playing action video games actually sharpens visual perception by up to 20%.
20%?
20%. These are video games that, like first-person shooters or action games where there's lots going on. Not games, they said, like Tetris, but something where there's more activity going on screen.
Actually, I kind of had an advantage here because I did my science fair project like in the 8th grade on whether or not video games improve your hand-eye coordination. I mean, I found that they did, but I pretty much made up all the data, so maybe that didn't really help me.
One of the researchers, Bavalier, said, when people play action games, they're changing the brain's pathway responsible for visual processing. Those games push the human visual system to the limits of the brain, and the brain adapts to it. That learning carries over into other activities and possibly everyday life. This also isn't the only study. I can't remember if we might have had one or two of these on fact or fiction, on science or fiction before. There was a study that showed that certain kinds of surgeons, those that do laparoscopic surgery or endoscopic surgery where they use a little tiny video camera, that those who play video games actually have fewer complications in doing surgery with you know, video equipment, basically. And there are other studies which show that, you know, video game use actually positively correlates with hand-eye coordination, with overall intelligence.
I bet you the military has a lot of data on that, because I know they utilize video games quite a bit.
Yes, you're right. I mean, a lot of this is military. And the military are on the leading edge in many ways of using immersive sort of video games for training. And in fact, they have the best simulator, like sort of first-person combat simulator, that was actually then turned into a game for the civilian market. But they use it to sort of put soldiers through tactical situations, you know? So video games are good for you.
Go ahead, kids. Tell your parents that.
I keep telling my wife that. Obviously, like anything, it is to a certain degree. Unfortunately, it's probably also contributing to our obesity problem because people are spending a lot of time sitting in a chair playing video games.
Unless you use the Wii.
That's right, use the Wii. So everything in moderation, obviously, it's good. You need physical activity, but video games, the bottom line is they're good mental and visual activity that actually does have an effect on your processing.
Yeah, but they also promote snacking, which is bad
for
you.
Yeah, they are very snack-promoting. So, Evan, please tell us the answer to last week's puzzle.
The answer to last week's puzzle is the Abominable Snowman. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
I knew it.
The Cardiff Giant. The Cardiff Giant. And I'm actually surprised that the correct answers came in rather quickly. You know, the Cardiff Giant is just something that's, you know, not at the front of many skeptical topics these days. It's kind of something tucked away.
It's old school.
It is. It's still one of my favorite stories. And certainly when someone like Kenny Fader presents it, it's just, you know, I love it.
He could get a laundry list and make it fun.
Kenny is our skeptical archaeologist. He has a good talk about the Cardiff Giant. My favorite part about that story, so again, just quickly for background, this was, what, about 100 years ago?
Yep.
It was a stone carving of a giant that somebody carved and buried in their backyard for a year and tried to make it look old and then chopped it around as a fossilized giant person. And then who was the famous
PC
Barnum?
Barnum.
Yeah, the famous huckster. He tried to buy the Cardiff Giant from the guy who
for
wouldn't sell it.
$60,000.
So he just made a fake one.
Yep.
And then he started shopping around a fake of the fake. And it didn't matter.
Does that make it real then?
This is PT Barnum's, you know, he's the guy who said there's a sucker born every minute. Is that apocryphal, by the way, that he really
He did
said
not
that?
Say it. Yeah. Actually, he's attributed to saying it, but he didn't say it. Somebody
really?
Else said it, and I don't have, unfortunately, that reference in front of me, but when I was looking up this my little write-up for the Cardiff Giant, it mentioned that it's falsely attributed to Barnum.
That's very common, by the way, that pithy quotes are often attributed to more famous people than the people who actually said them. So famous people tend to accumulate.
Yeah, they didn't have podcasts at the time, so...
Right, that's right. Well, what's our puzzle for this week?
Well, actually, okay, but first we have to tell you that David Tyler emailed in the correct answer first. He beat Mike on the message boards by just a minute, but David Tyler is the winner. So congratulations, David.
Well done.
Good work, Dave.
Well done. Now for the latest, greatest puzzle. Here you go, folks. Identify this number sequence, okay? 10.
Fibonacci. No, I'm sorry.
10, 1, 5, 25, 50.
Oops, sorry.
For a good time, call 10, 1, 5,
25, 50.
What was the sequence again?
10, 1, 5, 25, 50. Good luck, everyone. Enjoy that one.
That's a logic puzzle.
Identify the sequence. There's a trick in there somewhere.
No, never.
Bob, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yeah, I've got a quote by Anaxagoras, circa 475 BC.
He was so cool.
He was the first philosopher to visit Athens, and clearly ahead of his time. He said, "Everything has a natural explanation. The moon is not a god, but a great rock, and the sun, a hot rock.
That is pretty far ahead of its time. But, you know, it seems amazing to us that the ancient Greeks would say something that does seem, again, so far ahead of, quote-unquote, like, medieval thinking. But actually, the ancient Greeks pretty much got everything right. I mean, most of the ideas that there are to think, the ancient Greek philosophers thought them. They pretty much had everything down. You can find some Greek philosopher who basically said anything. It's hard to come up with anything new.
The Matrix was
nothing
was
new
cool.
Under the sun.
Certainly that's true of Hollywood. It's hard for them to come up with anything new.
That's true.
But that's another story for another time.
Well, everyone, thanks again for joining me. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Good episode.
Thanks, Steve. Good show.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.